Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. Just a heads up before you listen to this episode. There's a good bit of salty language in it, including at least one really offensive word. So if you're not in the mood for that, or if you're listening with somebody you don't want to expose to that, then try this one later. Thanks. Otherwise, enjoy. This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Mount Vernon.
A city police officer taking legal action against the city and the department.
The question has been called, who shall police the police?
Think about what it means in our community to keep people safe and to hold people accountable.
It affects me when I see stuff like that because I've lived it. But I'm not silly enough to think that you can defund that the way. That doesn't go.
Hands up! Something about the George Floyd murder really knocked me to my knees, and I had to ask myself, what was different about this? And for me, it was bearing witness to that officer looking right into the camera, as he murdered him.
You are hired to protect and serve and uphold the law. You are not above the law.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. For huge numbers of people, George Floyd's murder was either an awakening about the wanton violence and impunity that defines so much police behavior in Black neighborhoods, or it was a reminder of the urgency of the problem. The moment seemed ripe for change. A lot of that energy got subsumed in the overall outrage over Donald Trump. And even today, a lot of people were fixated on his speech. He just continues to take up so much space in our public conversation. But the problems with policing, which sent so many people into the streets this past summer, they haven't gone away either. And we are going to return to them as often as possible on this show. We are particularly interested in how much unaccountable, unmonitored power police wield as individual officers and as departments overall. And as we know, that kind of power can corrupt. One of my colleagues in the WNYC newsroom, George Joseph, has spent months investigating allegations of such corruption in one police department, in a small city just outside of New York, in a town called Mount Vernon, north of the Bronx. George obtained hours and hours of audio recordings, tapes that were secretly made by a Mount Vernon police officer who was appalled by what he witnessed. Multiple allegations of illegal behavior, stuff like outright theft from residents, and brutality associated with that behavior. The tapes are startling.
I've never seen it on the level that I've seen it in Mount Vernon, dude.
One thing about this department, it's a racist department, dogs.
I said I've seen brutality for confessions, I've seen robberies.
Something needs to be done about this department. Something needs to be done.
We're going to spend this whole show with George Joseph in Mount Vernon, learning the results of his investigation. To me, it's a story about the fever that consumed so many cities as they raced into the war on drugs, decades ago at this point, and how the choices they made in that fog still define so much about law enforcement in America. To start the story, I asked George to set the scene in Mount Vernon.
Mount Vernon's a small, really community-rooted city. It's just 4 square miles, really small, 70,000 residents, right across the northern border of the Bronx, but a lot of New Yorkers don't even know it. You know, for me, in fact, the first time I heard about Mount Vernon was in that Nas song, "The World Is Yours" from Illmatic.
Oh.
The world is yours, everybody at Mount Vernon. The world is yours.
He kind of shouts out Mount Vernon like one of the centers of Black culture in New York.
How about that?
This small community has produced so many famous people, artists, actors, Denzel Washington. Back in the 60s, Nina Simone was next door neighbors there with Betty Shabazz.
When you're young, gifted and black.
In the 80s, a bunch of hip hop artists, Sean, Puff Diddy, Heavy D, they all came up through Mount Vernon.
That I definitely had no idea. It's kind of like the Harlem Renaissance in Mount Vernon.
At least in Westchester. I mean, you can hear Heavy D how much he loves this place. These are his streets. These are his shops where he grew up.
Born in Jamaica, Mount Vernon, I grew. But I still do my shopping off of Avenue. Buy my Nikes from Chambers, then walk down a block. Get the gear that I wear from Buddy's Big Man Shop.
but it's also historically been a very segregated town. You know, there's the phrase, across the other side of the tracks.
Right.
That's literally the case in Mount Vernon. The Metro North rail line just cuts right through the city.
Stopping at Mount Vernon East.
And the North and South are divided, North being historically Irish and Italian, and South being historically Black. And that segregation has been there and intense, and it still exists to this day.
Are you ready now?
Yeah, I'm ready.
One of the people I spoke with in my reporting is Alan Seward.
Go back a little bit, and to the degree you can, try to be chronological.
Okay, so we started back.
You know, he was a young Black kid growing up in the 70s and 80s and remembers just trying to go up to the North Side because that's where one of the movie theaters was.
Back in the days, that was our only movie theater, top of the hill.
And the Italian kids and even adults would chase him and his friends out because he was Black.
Then the white kids chase us back home. Get the niggers. We got a jet. Don't trip the wall because you're caught. I'm out. I already know I'm getting away. But, you know, sometimes you got to try to go back, pick somebody up. Because if you get caught now trying to be helpful, that'll get you beat up.
And this is as late as the 80s.
Yeah, this is definitely as late as the 80s. Yeah, it was one of those white ethnic enclaves that had a very rigid and hostile identity towards anyone that didn't come from the quote-unquote neighborhood.
You already knew, don't come in this town with no BS if you ain't from around there. Bottom line.
So in this kind of segregated world, there is just a lack of opportunity and downright poverty for people like Alan. And with the expansion of crack in the 80s, the city was just completely transformed.
These dudes turned into ghetto celebrities overnight. The change was so crazy.
He's just a young man seeing people that barely had any money last week. All of a sudden, they have nice clothes, nice shoes, everything they want.
And you just was begging for a fucking piece of chicken. Now you're driving the fucking newest Benz. Like,
he was a kid without much money. He wanted that stuff. And so that's what he pursued because that was the opportunity that he saw available to him.
When did you start dealing? How old were you?
Oh, I was 11. Started out selling dollar joints.
And he was a clever kid. He used his newspaper route to covertly sell on the streets.
I used to get up at 6 in the morning, throwing out the papers so it didn't look suspicious when I'm at this door, at this car. Boom. I said, yeah, when I'm at the car, I could be giving them a penny saver in a bag at the same time.
But I don't want to romanticize it too much. The violence that came alongside the drug trade was real. Alan remembers being a kid on his block. It was a dangerous place to be. People were getting shot there all the time. And that was just something he was used to.
Yeah, my block was crazy. They called it the red zone. My block was dark. So people would get you to walk down there and pop, pop. And you just hear shots and dudes cutting through backyards.
And you know, the response to all this was more pressure from law enforcement. About a decade earlier, New York State had passed some of the harshest drug laws in the country, known as the Rockefeller drug laws. Before crack, heroin was the big problem. And none of the rehabilitative programs or sort of soft criminal penalties were really working in lawmakers' minds. So New York starts cracking down zero tolerance on even small drug users, small dealers, all of a sudden they're going to prison for years.
Yeah.
That model started in New York, but it spread across the whole country.
So how did this kind of policing you're describing, how did that look on the streets in Mount Vernon then?
So in Mount Vernon and cities across the country, to be fair, police departments begin deploying these specialized units that were sort of given carte blanche to go out and do whatever they wanted, ride around in unmarked cars, wear regular clothes, not uniforms, and just clear off corners, push people up against walls, whatever they needed to do to sort of clear out the problem.
It's the kind of stuff like we're used to seeing from like The Wire and NWA videos, these cops that are as menacing as the criminals.
And that was understood. We need people to be as tough as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. The idea was if we basically search every young Black person in the hood who's walking around, maybe we'll find some guns and drugs, and maybe by doing that, we'll scare them into not holding the things that are associated with this violence that we're seeing. But that amount of power, which basically throws out all constitutional protections we have in real practical terms, you know, there was a lot of temptation to commit abuse. And in those days, one of the most notorious officers was this dashing drug warrior, a detective named James Garcia. He was this handsome, light-skinned cop with a big beard, tall. He even appeared on TV. He was on this CBS show called Top Cops, and he gets to make a monologue to the camera about how you really have to be in the war on drugs to fight it.
Narcotic work is risky and sometimes fatal. My first goal is to make arrests. The second is to go home. Sometimes I'm asked why I do what I do. I answer, if you want to win the drug war, you have to be in it.
But the dark underside, which they didn't show on TV, was that residents like Alan Seward had been complaining about brutality from the Mount Vernon Police Department for years.
My first encounter, I had the weed on lock.
Alan, he has this one horrific story as a young kid.
I was in front of my building when they snatched me this night.
He had his joints on him because that's what he was selling back then. And two officers pull up.
It was summertime, but it was probably like 8 o'clock at night. They're cruising through the hood. They had the brown square.
Alan remembers it like a brown Chevy.
It was Impala, old school back then. And they pulled up, jumped out. Dude starts scattering and all that. So I'm in front of my building. I don't feel I got to run. So he said, come here, shorty. He starts patting me down.
They search him.
I got like 10 joints in a cigarette pack. I used to keep it in the empty cigarette box because they already rolled up. He said, oh, so you smoke cigarettes? So he looks in the pack. He see that I got the weed. They throw me in the car. Now he's asking me, so how old are you anyway? So I said, well, I'm 15. So he's like, you sure you 15? I'm like, yeah, I'm 15. I got my high school ID card in my pocket.
Alan assumes that he's going to go to the police station, but that's not what happened. Back then, 15 was the age right before you could be charged criminally in New York State. And so instead of taking him to the police station, Alan notices...
we going straight down Union.
They're not on their way there. Like, what's going on?
So they took me straight on down. Right to Brush Park.
They pull up to this parking lot in a park nearby, not far from his home.
I'm wondering if they're going to just let me go.
But they take him out, and Alan says one of them starts punching him right in the gut.
Yeah, folded my little ass like a beach chair. I don't even know. I might have spit up blood.
He says that he was knocked down to the floor and left there, and they drove off.
I didn't get up until like 4 a.m. I got a whooping when I got home. It's crazy.
And was there ever any accountability for this police department or for this top cop, James Garcia, for that matter? Did anything ever happen to him?
So a few years later, in the mid-90s, the FBI was investigating corruption on the Mount Vernon police force. And as part of that investigation, they planted a duffel bag full of cash. And James Garcia and a supervisor ended up going into this apartment where this bag had been planted full of cash. And the FBI had hidden a camera there and caught Garcia on tape, taking the cash, putting it into his vest and handing some to his supervisor. And he pled guilty along with two others for this corruption and was off the force. But that really didn't change the fundamental DNA of policing in Mount Vernon. These narcotics units, these specialized squads, they continued for decades to have their way on the streets of Mount Vernon and black communities across the country like Mount Vernon. And the corruption scandals continued and continued.
Coming up, we'll hear how allegations of corruption and abuse are still a problem for the Special Narcotics Unit within the Mount Vernon Police Department and how one officer tried to change it.
What if millions of black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so George, you described how the response to crack and the rise of violent crime and all that that was going on in the 80s, it led the police departments to create these special units. How did that then evolve over the decades?
So all of these departments basically allowed these squads of officers to run the streets, gather information, and hopefully bring in arrests of people for guns and drugs. But you've basically allowed a unit to be out there without any supervision and all this knowledge about where this black market money and drugs, which is another form of money, are stashed. And so pretty soon, officers were like, well, why don't I take a cut of this? And we see this in cities across the country.
In the indictment unsealed today, federal prosecutors said the six officers stole upwards of $500,000.
In Philadelphia, there was a narcotics unit scandal where the feds caught this small group of drug police for grabbing dealers and hanging them off balconies and stealing tens of thousands of dollars in cash.
In another, several officers stole cocaine off a suspect and then sold it on the streets themselves.
In Los Angeles, you had an anti-gang unit called CRASH,
which officers routinely planted evidence, framed innocent people to secure arrests and convictions.
So we see how the police leaders basically were being permissive about whatever they wanted to do, and they had this sort of identity of themselves as warriors who had no rules whatsoever.
Kind of like a gang themselves.
And it's interesting because we have these then two counter narratives happening in the country alongside that, if we remember in the late 80s and early 90s, we're in like hip hop and in black culture.
The cops are in America actually kill kids.
People were narrating that kind of corruption that you're seeing.
And until these cops realize that we're not just going to continually get our butts kicked in the street and we will retaliate, they're not going to act like human beings.
And it feels like it all came together politically, at least, in the 1994 crime bill. I mean, this is the piece of legislation that most people probably know when they think about criminal justice.
Hi, everybody.
Particularly because
this is a tough, smart crime bill.
Our new president, Joe Biden, played a huge role in crafting and promoting that bill.
A bill that has 51 death penalties, 100,000 cops, tens of thousands of new prison cells, and the list goes on.
So what role did it play in the evolution of these units?
Yeah, so when we think of a bill like the 94 crime bill, we should think of it as the culmination of decades and decades of punitive pro-carceral policies. But it's important to remember that this bill was sending a signal at the federal level to all localities across the country, you know, keep doing what you're doing, but actually hypercharge it. Mm-hmm. Bring in more arrests. We'll give you more funding. It was almost a affirmation of what tens of thousands of localities and police departments and prosecutors' offices across the country were already doing themselves in these very localized and self-directed ways. And so in increasing funding for the war on drugs, they only further empowered the kinds of abuses that residents in the streets of cities like Mount Vernon were already suffering.
So instead of looking at the corruption, instead of looking at the problems and saying, ooh, we better rein this in some, this is literal money thrown into the fire to make it burn bigger. And so then what does that look like in a place like Mount Vernon? What happened then?
So in the decades that followed in Mount Vernon, especially in the late 90s, you did see a decline in violent crime, just like as happened across the country. But in Mount Vernon, unlike in New York City, let's say, that decline wasn't consistent. And thus, the sort of same tactics were not disbanded. Mm-hmm. So even up through the 2010s, the narcotics unit in Mount Vernon had several members who were the subject of civilian complaints for stealing money, for really humiliating strip and anal cavity searches, and for day-to-day frisks that made residents feel like they couldn't really walk around in their community without the threat of police putting their hands on them with or without justification.
You wanna let me talk? Go ahead. Don't interrupt.
Okay. So one of the officers who many of these complaints centered on was a detective named Camilo Antonini.
If you know me, you know what I do. If I come to you and I tell you to do something, there's a reason.
For example, there's this one resident I met in my reporting. He's a black resident. He sent me a video of one of his encounters with Camilo Antonini.
If I'm not going to get you dirty, at least I can ruin the day.
Antonini is a veteran of the Mount Vernon Police Department. For many years, he was on the narcotics unit as a detective. He came from the NYPD. He also served as a Marine.
Wow, I'm not going to harass you.
Okay, but what's the reason why
you're not going to harass you?
Antonini just walks up.
But I'm going to ask you for a favor.
What's that? Gets right up in this guy's face.
It's no favors. I don't do favors.
And starts frisking him and feeling up his pants.
Swallow.
Swallow what?
You could swallow.
I don't got nothing in my mouth. Why are you
open
asking me?
Open your mouth then. Swallow. Okay, good.
Well, why are you asking me open my mouth for? If you not harass me, what's the purpose?
My job.
What's your job though, man? Yeah.
And it seemed like he was pretty pissed off about this video he was taking.
Well, why are you frisking me for? What's the reason? Tell me. I'm asking you, tell me why are you frisking me?
Spread
what?
Spread.
My feet are spread. Look how wide you want me to go.
You're recording it, right?
Exactly. But you're not telling me.
What time is it?
He's standing on the street talking to his friend, and this officer feels like he has the right to touch him in this very personal way.
It's 7:14 in the evening.
They're always harassing somebody. Always.
And around this time, Antonini was really getting a reputation on the streets. Like Alan Seward, you know, the resident we talked about a lot earlier.
No. I'm a hood legend. You know what I'm saying? Everybody in this town knows me. I'm born and raised here.
You know, by this point, he'd become a well-known drug dealer in Mount Vernon, and he'd paid a price. He'd been in and out of prison for decades.
I come home from prison 2016, February 25th.
For what?
Drugs possession of cocaine.
By the time he comes back, he's hearing allegations about Antonini that remind him of what his childhood was like growing up in the 80s with the police department. Antonini was just well known.
When you hear the same stories all around, then they know that they're true.
And so by this point, Alan is how old? We left him at 15, but how old is he now?
By this point, he's in his late 40s. And, you know, after all these years, he's starting to get tired of the drug game.
You get tired of going to jail. Dudes come in the game thinking it's just get some drugs and sell it. No, it's really a job. You got to watch out for the snitches, the informants, the undercovers, the detectives riding, the blue coats, the good Samaritans in the window that want to call community watch. It's a whole lot of stuff that goes in tail with this. Then you got to measure and weigh everything to make sure you get your proper amount of money back.
Can't be a slacker.
Yeah, you got to make sure that you're making your profit. This is not just to be doing just to do.
And so if he's getting tired of this, but it's been his primary source of income, what's he going to do for money now?
I mean, he has some of his hustles, but he's also starting to take on low-wage, blue-collar work.
I get a job.
What do you do in that job?
I'm a teacher's aide/security guard.
He was just starting to think about doing something new with his life, but that plan didn't really work out.
Just go from the beginning of that night. Where were you?
Okay, I was in the bungalow, $2 Tuesdays.
So one night, Alan was at his favorite bar, which is on the south side of Mount Vernon, predominantly black.
I like the spot. I go there. I frequent it.
He was playing pool there, and he bets people for money by playing with one hand. He's called the one-handed bandit.
Yeah, so
you play with one hand sometimes. To be
all the
part
time.
Of the bet.
If the left hand touched the stick, you automatically win. I chalk up with the one hand, everything.
Okay, so Alan is very good at pool, is what
we're learning. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's good. He was having a good night that evening, and he had won a lot of games.
The guys just think they can win. They just want to try. Everybody want to beat the best, you know. Oh, you won't beat me with one hand, then I got to show them too.
But as he's in the middle of one of his games, you know, he's holding his pool stick. He's aware of his environment. He notices two guys in hoodies standing by the jukebox.
One guy looks like a white guy, could be Spanish, and then the other guy was black.
And, you know, he's been a guy that has been in plenty of run-ins himself on the street over many years. And he's a little concerned, like, who are these guys in the bar? And all of a sudden, they start approaching him.
So now I got the pool stick, like, about to swing it.
Ready to use it if he has to.
So he pulls the badges out.
They're police. And one of them, he says, is Camilo Antonini.
So then I put the pool stick down. I'm like, yo, what the fuck is y'all running down on me for?
So the cops drag him out of the bar.
Take me through the crowd.
And they take him out to their unmarked car, which is parked down the street.
He sticks me in the back seat like this. Ah! I'm like, what the fuck? I'm on my head. I'm fucked up.
And, you know, instead of just taking him and processing him at the station, he says they
pulled down his clothing.
He did not take my pants down.
On the street.
Yeah, on the street. And he says he frankly felt scared.
My first thought was he's going to try to rape me or something.
So according to him, his backside at this moment is just exposed to anyone who happened to be outside. And he says what ended up happening was Detective Antonini searched his anal cavity looking for drugs, but they didn't find anything.
Then they pulled my shit back up, put me in the car, and they took me to my daughter's crib on 1st and 3rd.
Police had already been searching his daughter's apartment.
You walk in.
When I walk in, I'm cuffed. My granddaughter runs up crying, Papa. She hugged me and shit. When I see my daughter's cuffed. Everybody in the house is cuffed except for my two granddaughters.
And who else is there?
My daughter. Just like that, Detective Antonini, Alan says, goes into another room and comes back holding 10 grams of a white substance, presumably cocaine.
Now he's like, hey, look at this. I found 10 grams. So my daughter yells, Dad, they searched before you got here. They didn't find nothing. So I said, oh, you can put that back in your pocket.
The implication is that he planted the drugs.
Yeah, that's what Alan says. These drugs weren't his. The detective had suddenly pulled them out.
So hold on. When you're in the apartment and Anthony comes out with this bag, what are you thinking?
He's trying to set me up.
What does it look like?
It's a glassine bag. It could have been baby powder. I don't know what he had.
So then what happened?
So police take him to the department, and he says they put him in a small interrogation room.
This is the fuck you up box. You can tell.
And how did you feel going into that room?
Oh, nervous as hell. And I'm handcuffed too.
And after all this stuff that's happened, this is according to Alan, Antonini is suddenly coming to him with a deal.
This is when he starts telling me, yo, isn't this me and you in here? But I'm saying to you, man to man, like, you got kids. You don't want your kids to get shot. The only thing that could kill me is a gun. I want the guns off the street. I don't care about the drugs. You tell me where somebody that got gun right now. You could take the 10 grams, go out this door right here. It's a door right there. You can go out this door right now. You can get money. And you won't got to worry about getting arrested. All you got to do is just give me your information.
So this is all quite a remarkable set of events. I mean, if even a little bit of that is true, it's really shocking. So they've found these drugs that he says were planted, taken him to this room, and now they want to say, okay, here's what we want in return.
Exactly. But the deal that Alan says he was offered is not something he was used to. You know, Alan's been in the drug game at this point for a long time, and he's normally used to police saying, if you give us some information, you can work off this charge, or we'll be lenient on this charge, or that kind of thing. But what he says Detective Antonini offered him in that room by themselves was, one, you can go take these drugs that I supposedly found on you and go deal them, and I'm not going to have a problem as long as you're giving me information. Alan would become like a factory of arrests for them.
Right.
So it's not only a gift, like a goodie bag of drugs, but also future impunity, which is not what Alan was used to.
And I was like, that's how you do it? That's how you be getting these guys? He was like, you'll be surprised how many rats I got on my team. I was like, I'm not surprised, but I just know you don't got this rat. You don't got me on your team.
He felt like that really violated his street ethic. Like, you don't work with cops. You don't accept gifts from them. But according to him, the consequence was he was going to be charged. And he feels like, who's going to believe his story that he was coerced, that he was planted on? I mean, it was his word, a black drug dealer from the hood in Mount Vernon,
yeah,
versus this detective, a decorated, highly productive officer.
Some guys, because if they green and they never been through anything, they're going to be shook. So they're going to be like, oh, man, you really? Now he's like, yeah, this 10 grams is going to stick. And you're going to go up north for 12 to 16 years. Or you can tell me who got the guns right now, and I'll let you go out that door right there. Because you're not even on record as being arrested. So it's easy for him to let you go.
But what Alan and Antonini, the detective in that moment, didn't know was that someone inside the police department had started to gather evidence about what the department, especially the narcotics unit, had been up to for many years.
It's totally wrong. You know what I mean?
It's really bad in Mount Vernon.
It's really bad. It's so blatant in Mount Vernon.
So in early 2020 last year, I was handed this big pile of phone recordings from a patrol officer named Mershia Bavel.
I'm not playing, man. I'm not playing because this shit needs to stop.
Officer in the Mount Vernon Police Department came to the department around the same time that Antonini did.
Everything they do is illegal, bro.
Yo.
And Bavel says that he had witnessed some of the same kinds of misconduct that residents had been complaining about for years, involving Antonini and other officers in the unit.
With everything that's happening with the corruption, you know what I mean? I'm going to put light on it.
And he decided to document what was going on by recording his fellow officers.
Antonini's been slapping people around for some time. Mm-hmm. And that's what he does. He uses intimidation tactics to allow people to be scared of him in the street.
So we're talking about collaborating with drug dealers, of beating people up in handcuffs in the station.
And I wasn't having it. You know, being a part of this corrupted unit didn't sit right with me.
Listen, he has stolen money. You know what I'm saying? I tell you, when I go on search warrants, yo, he be grabbing money like, yo, you seeing this? Anybody seeing this? Ready to pocket that gun.
These sorts of allegations were twirling around the whole unit, mm-hmm. and he wanted to get evidence to prove that what he was saying was not just his word, but something that was really happening that no one could deny.
I'm working in a police department where I know that things can be covered up. Mm-hmm. All right? That's the reality of it. You know, that things that are out of your control can be controlled by someone else.
Yo.
What's up?
What's good, bro? How you doing?
Yeah, man.
So one of the officers who Bavel recorded the most is a guy named John Campo, who had also been on the force for several years.
I've never seen it on the level that I've seen it in Mount Vernon, dude.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like that before. Like, it's like its own little country.
You know what,
a dictator.
You know what, and you can hear in the tapes that Campo sounds uncomfortable with the things that are happening around him and with the people that he's working with every day.
One thing about this department is a racist department, dogs. You gotta understand.
Hold on one second. Yeah, sorry, it's my dad. It's a bottle.
What
happened? I make a bottle for my son.
Oh.
But I can't work with racist people. I can't work with people that are, that's not how I am. That's not how I grew up. It's not me, you know what I'm saying? My kids are Spanish, you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
One of my kids is mad dark, you know what I'm saying? Like,
it's not just like Campo is talking about things he saw, although that is a lot of it.
They had their undercover identify the wrong suspects on numerous occasions after they were told that that wasn't the person that he bought from. So they're going to indict people on state charges or whatever the fuck it is that don't deserve to be indicted because they weren't even the right person that he bought from.
He also talks about things he was involved in.
What I'm trying to tell you is this.
For example, there's a part of the tapes where Campo's describing he and a colleague arresting this well-known drug dealer for shooting craps on the street with some of his friends.
They're rolling dice in front of the building.
You know, that's a low-level arrest, but what happens next is kind of remarkable. Campo says the guy basically gives him an order.
The dude looks at me, he's like, yo, Campo, I got 40 rocks in my pocket. Take it out of my pocket and stash it somewhere.
Wow. The guy has crack cocaine in his pocket, and he's telling this police officer to go stash the drugs and hide them.
So I took the 40 rocks of crack out of his pocket and put it in my sneaker.
He's basically giving the police an order to do something highly suspect so that he can get the drugs back after he's processed at the station for this low-level dice-rolling violation.
Because it's so known on the street that this is the kind of thing that goes on. And so Campo is on tape describing this?
Yeah, you know, Campo makes clear that this guy was one of their best informants who had been part of this sort of arrangement where dealers were allowed to do whatever they wanted, putting the drugs back on the street.
And they allowed him to sell drugs with free rein. And they just pick off the guys that he sells to.
Get the hell out of here.
I swear to God.
And they let the dude keep the sales from the
Yeah, that's what they do. That's not part of the rules, bro.
And so we see very clearly from the way Campo's talking, he feels like this kind of behavior is being rewarded by supervisors.
Wow.
He's like, bro, did he have anything on him? He's like, yeah. He's like, oh, did you stash it for him? He's like, yeah. He's like, all right, good.
Yo, bro.
The important thing to understand here and what these recordings, these tapes reveal is that the unit cared more about keeping these kinds of people out on the streets so that they could generate arrests in collaboration with them, low-level drug arrests, rather than actually going up the ladder and getting the people that were bringing in large quantities of drugs into the community.
This is backwards. This is just numbers.
You know, and it wasn't just coercing dealers after they had been arrested. Someone like Alan says they were willing to plant drugs on people in order to force them into this arrangement where they ran the streets racking up these numbers as an end in itself.
It's dumb. Like, when I was in narcotics, yo, I went and I got big shit, man. You know what I mean? Mm. I'm focused on the shit that's poisoning the community. I'm not trying to poison the community. What am I doing? Yeah. I got to go home. That don't make me feel good. That don't make me feel I'm not doing the right. Just going backwards. You know what I mean? Why? For what?
You know, George, listen to this. What's so striking to me is you can't really make a bad apple argument here. When you think about abusing individuals, okay, so maybe that's like this one officer who's just really awful. But this is so mundane that it feels systemic.
And this had been going on for years, according to Bevel. And in the tapes, you can really hear him trying to draw what Campo knows out of him.
Seriously, this is from me to you, off the record. Give me something. Give me somebody, date and time, that Antonini fucked on. You don't worry about nothing.
Encouraging him to tell him stuff that Bevel could use in his campaign to bring accountability in his mind to the department.
Yo, Campo, dog, you have the power. You will have the opportunity, the capability to shut all this shit down. You know what I mean? You are a duly sought police officer. Sworn in to protect the people of your community and the United States of fucking America. Your jurisdiction is Mount Vernon. You know what I mean?
Yes.
New York. You have due diligence to make the public aware what the fuck is going on.
Coming up, we'll look at what impact these recordings had in Mount Vernon and what they've meant for residents like Alan Seward. Hey, everybody. So this year, I spent a lot of February thinking seriously about Black History Month and why it leaves me kind of cold. And I learned the cool origin story of the celebration. I hung out with people like Saidiya Hartman and Bernice McFadden, and we even went to a Black History party. So anyway, we've gathered all of these shows together on our website in case you missed some of them, or if maybe you want to share the whole package with somebody, which I hope maybe you'll do because I think they're good conversation starters. Just go to wnyc.org/anxiety. You'll see a tab there labeled Collections. And when you click through on that, you'll find the series. It's called The Future of Black History. So check it out. And thanks for listening. When we left off, this officer in Mount Vernon, Mirashay Bevel, had started recording other officers as a way to prove what was happening there. So what did those recordings ultimately reveal?
So there are several officers that Bevel had known for years and was secretly recording.
Yeah, what's up, man?
Oh, shit.
And they're just straight up talking about incidents of corruption and misconduct that they said they'd seen.
Yo, why they scared of Antonini, man?
Because he be beating motherfuckers' heads in, that's why. I can't stand it, man.
For example, John Campo, that officer we had talked about earlier.
Come on, Bevel.
Yo, what's good?
He even prepared a list, which he gave to department leaders at the time.
So, yeah, whatever I tell you, you can't say to nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. You can't mention it to anybody in conversation, nothing like that.
And the list, you know, included everything from an officer assaulting someone in front of a supervisor.
I've seen brutality for confessions. I've seen robberies.
An incident where he thought that his colleagues had planted drugs on someone, you know, in effect framing them.
Illegally entering people's homes and threatening them.
You know, strip searches without justification, like everything you could think of. He even mentioned this thing called the Rainy Day Fund.
I said illegal crack pipes and drugs are always on the person. They call it the Rainy Day Fund.
With the implication being there that officers were holding evidence on themselves just in case they ever needed to use it, presumably for planting.
So that's basically what I told them.
Wow.
You know, the officers themselves are painting a picture of an extremely corrupt unit that is making its own rules and deciding how to apply justice for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the kind of stuff Alan Seward claims was happening to him.
All you got to do is rub the wrong rat the wrong way, and they can throw you into a conspiracy case and fuck your whole world up. And you didn't do absolutely nothing. Then if you can't prove your whereabouts, your alibi don't stick, you're going to be in prison.
So then what did Bavel do with these recordings? And did they provide enough evidence that he was actually able to put an end to some of this stuff?
So Bavel sent the recordings eventually to the Westchester County District Attorney. That's the local county prosecutors, which he also happened to record.
Nice to reach out to you. I'm in the Public Integrity Bureau. And
Bavel and his attorney are like hoping that they would launch an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, did you guys develop anything? Is there any merit to any of this?
Oh, the audios?
Yeah.
The audios are very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I went through them all. There's a lot in there. The Campo stuff.
But what we know, based on some of his meetings with them...
You telling us something that happened to someone else, there's only so much I can do with that.
Is that they say something to the effect of, we haven't moved forward on this. We tried calling you. We thought you weren't interested anymore.
I called you and I mentioned we closed it out.
We closed the investigation.
If you want to go forward and you actually want to work with us regarding these types of things, then that's a different story.
But his lawyer's like, wait, what? You're relying on us?
The problem I'm having is...
You're the one that is now sitting on all this evidence, and you haven't done anything?
This is... People stay in New York. You guys have an interest in rooting out corruption more than we do. It should be on your own that you're investigating this and calling these people in who are on the recordings and trying to, you know, decipher what's going on. I would think... I
mean, and so you got to remember, like, what Bavel was thinking in this moment. He's been waiting for months and months thinking that the DA is going to do something, but they didn't really do much of anything.
I'm not saying you're doing this, but recordings can be modified. They can be changed. You can delete parts of them. You can do other things. So recording on its own, it's hard to say.
So the bottom line is these prosecutors, the very people who are tasked with overseeing the police, were sitting on hours of tapes detailing numerous allegations of rampant corruption in this unit. And in the meantime, while they had these tapes, they continued to push forward cases based on the word of the very officers who were the subject of these accusations and these recordings. And the district attorney didn't mention these allegations at all to the very defendants, most of whom happened to be black, at least in Mount Vernon, who were being charged based on the work of these officers.
The process does not work. I follow the protocol to resolve these issues, and it was swept under the carpet.
You know, Bavel felt like he couldn't trust his department. He felt he couldn't trust his county prosecutors.
You gotta understand, my mindset then, I'm by myself. It's not like I have a master plan. Okay, if this doesn't work, you do this, you do that, you do that. No, I'm terrified. I don't know what to do.
So his attorney and him come to me, give me this trove of recordings. And when I listen to them, I'm shocked. Like, these are active duty officers who are still on the force, not knowing they're being recorded, talking about all this stuff.
So he's done millions of things, criminal acts. He's a criminal, and you're allowing him to go to the county. I don't understand how that fucking works.
Yeah.
And, George, presumably, had you not gotten these tapes and we had not started playing them on WNYC, no one would have known about these allegations in the first place, right? I mean, so what impact has your reporting had on all this?
You know, I was surprised, but they came out at a very particular moment.
You can see police here now firing tear gas into the crowd.
This is, you know, last summer,
yeah,
at the height of the protests over the police killing of George Floyd.
We can't peacefully protest in the streets without getting tear gas thrown at us for what?
And in that environment, a lot of people started to pay attention to it.
I would like to introduce Westchester District Attorney candidate Mimi Rocha.
For DA of Westchester County, where she's taking on the incumbent Anthony Scarpino in the Democratic primary.
The local context is that there was a very intense primary fight for the Westchester County DA's race for the Democratic Party candidate. Mm-hmm. And it was the incumbent versus a newcomer named Mimi Rocha, a former federal prosecutor.
I am running to be the next district attorney in Westchester County, where I live with my family. Right,
and when the stories came out, she really made this a campaign issue.
The public needs to have faith in these very serious cases and investigations.
She was like, this is not how a responsible DA is supposed to act. You're supposed to investigate this stuff. You're supposed to disclose this stuff. You can't just bury it and keep prosecuting people without telling them.
The Westchester DA, the current Westchester DA, was given recordings that raised credible allegations about police corruption and brutality right here in Westchester County in Mount Vernon.
Since then, Mimi Rocha won the race handily, and she's actively pursuing this investigation.
That is the only way we can move forward as a community, as a country, in this time.
And so what about this officer you described earlier, Camilo Antonini? What happened to him?
Right now, Detective Antonini has been put on desk duty, so he's still collecting a paycheck, but he's not on the street doing the kind of narcotics work that he was years ago. And other officers, the department has said, are no longer on the street doing plainclothes activities, driving around in unmarked cars. John Campo, one of the officers that Bavel recorded a lot, was suspended without pay. And so, you know, what role he plays in a potential investigation, if anything, has yet to be determined.
And then how did Antonini and these other officers, how they respond to these allegations? I mean, have you managed to talk to any of them or get a response from the police department in general?
You know, the department has long maintained that they are investigating these allegations. And in terms of individual officers, for the most part, they have either not responded or declined to comment on the record. And in a few cases, told us that they weren't involved in wrongdoing or that we're getting the story wrong, but nothing very specific on the record.
But the bigger question here is this special narcotics unit in the first place, right? I mean, that's the structural problem, is that these units are so often responsible for this kind of damage in Black communities and brown communities all over the country. So what happened to that unit in Mount Vernon?
You know, after our series came out, the department eventually announced that they had disbanded that unit. But the thing is, they created another called the Violent Crime Unit, which it's not exactly the same, but it does have some of the same enforcement elements like plainclothes officers. Right. But, you know, when you talk to residents who have criminal histories in Mount Vernon, what they'll often say is, you know, I copped out. I took a plea because who's going to believe me versus the word of an officer, someone with a badge? And that dynamic, to some degree, has changed in Mount Vernon because these tapes featuring officers themselves talking about police misconduct are now out there.
Right.
And there's many people in Mount Vernon and Westchester County, especially Black residents, who have come out of the woodwork and are now taking legal action, whether that be seeking expungements of their convictions or filing lawsuits to get compensation for the harms that they say were done to them by this unit. And Alan Seward is one of them.
This time, I see a light at the end of the tunnel, so this is why I feel better putting the gloves on this time.
People get railroaded all the time, you know what I'm saying? But it's just sometimes you gotta stand for something where you're gonna always fall for anything.
George, thank you for sharing all of this reporting with us.
Well, thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Joe Plourd mixed the podcast version. Matthew Miranda was at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. A special thanks this week for a bunch of extra work. Thanks to Jamie Floyd, the editor of WNYC's Race and Justice Unit, and to engineers Bill Moss and Wayne Schulmeister. Also, thanks to Celia Muller for such careful legal review of our reporting, and to our own Christopher Wirth for producing this episode. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Froman is our executive producer. and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at @Kai_Wright. And of course, as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.